Hello, everyone. This is Megan. I know it's been quite a while since I uploaded new content here, but that's because I've been busy producing for the Dragonlance Canticle podcast, owned and operated by the Dragonlance Nexus. If you want to listen to what I've been up to over there, check out the link in the show notes. Since I took over that podcast, creating more Dragonlance content here seems a bit redundant. Therefore, I've decided to take this show in a new direction. Going forward, this show will be dedicated to horror gaming, meaning Ravenloft and Call of Cthulhu to start, but hopefully branching off into other games like Vampire and Alien RPG in the future. I'm planning to include segments on horror movies, novels, and video games as well. In the meantime, I am going to be releasing the 3 Patreon-exclusive episodes I recorded previously, starting with the Magic the Gathering novel, The Brothers' War, by Jeff Grubb. And don't forget, you can always listen to me at my history podcast, Death Zone, if you just can't get enough of me. I currently have a 6-part series available on the first expeditions to summit Mount Everest, the disappearance of world-renowned climber George Mallory, and the theories surrounding his last days, including my own analysis of whether he might have summited Everest 30 years before Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Links in the show notes, of course. Lastly, I am now running paid weekly games of D&D at startplaying.games using Foundry as my virtual tabletop. If you're interested in playing D&D with me, please email me directly at dndbookclub@gmail.com or contact me on Twitter or Instagram at Miss Megan J. Thank you all for your support, and I hope you'll continue along with me down this new road. During a pandemic, one of the first things abandoned is compassion. It was true during the Black Death, when people abandoned their loved ones to die alone for fear of becoming infected, and it's true today. But what if a voice of compassion spoke to you, easing all your fears, promising to fix everything wrong with the world? What would you be willing to sacrifice to make that promise come true? What if the cure was worse than the disease? The Exile. Yawgmoth stepped off Pilgrim Way and stood on a rocky overlook. The desert was a vast, dun-colored disk far below. It did not seem so much a place, but a non-place. From this height, scrub brush and stunted trees seemed only lichens clutching an infertile stone. Footpaths and game trails formed a fragile net across the ground. A long, single highway cut through the desert, linking the 8 Thran city-states to their capital, Halcyon. Yawgmoth had walked every step along that highway. The Elder Council had revoked his banishment, had summoned him from the ends of the world, but demanded that he leave his exiled comrades and report to the capital of the Empire, but they had apparently felt no need to provide transportation. While he walked Pilgrim Way, hundreds of skyships had passed overhead. Cargoes of grain and ale were apparently more precious than Yawgmoth. He didn't mind. Yawgmoth was young, only 35, well-muscled and taller than most other Thran. His tan skin withstood even the blazing desert sun. His thick black hair formed a natural visor over his eyes. Dirty and tattered travel robes hid a body tuned to hard labor and deprivation. He didn't mind the deadly journey or the council's insulting disregard. He was used to both. Before receiving his summons, Yawgmoth and all practitioners of medical healing had been officially banished from the Empire. Their exile concluded a civil war that had begun 100 years ago. It had been a war of city-state sovereignty. When Halcyon solidified its position as the capital of the Empire, the war became politicized as a battle between artificers and eugenicists. Artificers believed in improving the Thran by building them bigger and better machines. Eugenicists believed in improving the Thran by dissecting and understanding the machines of biology. Both wanted to improve the Thran. There was no conflict between real artificers and real eugenicists. Each faction, though, was championed by the political party, the artificers by the elite imperialists, and the eugenicists by the republican rabble. When at last the rabble were defeated, their eugenicist champions were scapegoated and exiled. Yawgmoth and his 200 followers had wandered for 5 years among the lizard men and minotaurs, goblins and orcs, studying the diseases that plagued them. the only other Thran eugenicists ever saw were outcasts, lepers, and lunatics. It was no matter. Lepers and lunatics aided Yawgmoth's research of pathogens and contagions. Though the Elder Council had thought banishment would punish the eugenicists for their unorthodox approach to healing, it only provided a crucible in which to perfect their art. Disease and dysfunction were not caused by evil spirits or blocked mana pathways or lunar cycles. They were caused by tiny creatures that invaded a body much like an army might invade a nation. They were caused by malfunction of physical processes. The human body was no more than a complex mechanism, a machine like a mana rig. The Thran didn't need to rely on healers and their attendant monkery. A rigorous study of living organisms, proper function, common dysfunction, and disease species could render a completely material and mundane program for healing. Now the Elder Council was in need of Yawgmoth's new science. The great artificer Glacian was rotting like a common leper. Magic only made him worse. He had languished for a year in this pathetic state. At last, the outcast had been summoned. A smile spread across Yawgmoth's lips. His own people finally realized they needed him. And now that they realized it, Yawgmoth would never let them forget it. Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be discussing The Thran by J. Robert King, published in 1999 by Wizards of the Coast, inspired by the lore of the Magic the Gathering card game. The Thran is technically a prequel to a novel we've already discussed on this podcast, The Brothers' War by Jeff Grubb, but you don't need to read one before reading the other. Kind of like how you don't need to watch The Phantom Menace to enjoy A New Hope, and just because you enjoyed A New Hope doesn't mean you'll enjoy The Phantom Menace. In fact, you probably won't. That being said, if you haven't already listened to my episode featuring The Brothers' War, you may want to go back and listen to that one first. As usual, this episode will contain spoilers, so if you'd rather read the novel first, stop listening now. Before I dive into The Thran, I want to place it in its context. The Magic the Gathering novel series suffered from something of an identity crisis in the early days. To explain what I mean, let's jump back in time 25 years. The year is 1995. Bill Clinton is President of the United States. Forrest Gump is the best picture of the year. O.J. Simpson is once again a free man. A young Alanis Morissette dominates the airwaves, and Magic the Gathering is a cultural phenomenon. Don't get me wrong, it's still extremely popular today, unlike Alanis Morissette and O.J. Simpson, but the entire concept was brand new and exciting back then, and it took the world of nerds by storm. Whether you are into collectibles like toys or baseball cards, whether you are a fan of fantasy settings and tropes, or whether you just like the strategy of the game, it provided something for everyone to enjoy. As more expansions of the game were released, the lore of the game expanded as well. Names of places and people used to flavor the text of the cards began to repeat, as well as themes in the art and the cards themselves, and could be woven together into something like a narrative. TSR, the makers of Dungeons & Dragons, a game very similar in tone to Magic, if not in a mechanical sense, was doing well for itself publishing novels inspired by its game lore. Why not Magic, too? Of course, it's not so simple. Dungeons & Dragons is very much a story-based game. The players in a D&D adventure are essentially telling a semi-improvised story together. The first Dragonlance novels were literally based on a game session of Dungeons & Dragons. Magic, on the other hand, is simply one player battling another, and you play as yourself. There's no roleplay element to it. It's competitive, not cooperative, and story is as incidental to a game of Magic as it is to a baseball game. It may happen organically, but it's not something the players deliberately evoke. Most games are straightforward duels to the death. Between 1994 and 1996, the novels essentially reflected this. The first Magic the Gathering novel I ever read was also the first ever published, Arena by William Fortune, and it centers on a character who is a magic-wielding gladiator, not unlike a Magic the Gathering player themselves within the game's optional meta structure. Honestly, it's been a long time since I read it, but Arena is very much a standalone novel that anyone could pick up and read. It doesn't require any knowledge of the game's lore to understand, nor would reading it in any way deepen your appreciation of the game. The marketing might as well have been, "Do you like fantasy novels? Do you like Magic the Gathering? Read this, it's kind of both, but not as good as either." This brings us to 1996, and the beginning of a series of connected novels called the Artifact Cycle. With the publishing of the first novel of the Artifact Cycle, The Brothers' War, the lore of the novels and the cards began to sync up. The focus of both became the character of Urza, who had fought a war with his brother Mishra, which had nearly destroyed the planet Dominaria, and then became a planeswalker capable of traveling to different worlds, and eventually came into conflict with Yawgmoth, the ruler of a plane called Phyrexia, who himself had once been in conflict with a people called the Thran. This larger backstory was hinted at within the card expansion called Antiquities, released in 1993, but now it had been fully fleshed out by author Jeff Grubb. The second novel in the Artifact Cycle, Planeswalker by Lynn Abbey, was released in 1998, as well as the card expansion called Urza's Saga, and at last the novels and the cards were drawing their lore from the same pool. The Magic the Gathering novel series had found its identity at long last. So how does today's novel, The Thran, fit into all of this? As I said before, The Thran is a prequel to the entire Artifact Cycle, telling the story of the original conflict between the Thran and the Phyrexians, and setting up several plot devices which would be important in the Brothers' War. Although The Thran was originally released as a standalone story, it was later folded into the Artifact Cycle as the first book in that series, despite being published later than the Brothers' War. If I can strain my earlier Star Wars metaphor, The Phantom Menace is, like The Thran, given the title of Episode 1, but that doesn't make it the first Star Wars movie. Okay, that's enough context. Let's dive into The Thran by J. Robert Kane. The city called Halcyon is the crown jewel of the Thran Empire, a continent-spanning union of 9 city-states allied with various independent nations. It is a time of peace, prosperity, and unprecedented technological breakthroughs. The man behind these advancements is Glaceon, the greatest mechanical genius the world has ever known, basically the Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla or Elon Musk of his time. Glaceon is responsible for the operation of a machine called the Mana Rig, a device located within a volcano, which channels and harnesses the power of the Earth itself to create power stones. Power stones are crystals containing magical energy, which can be put to all kinds of wonderful and practical uses, and deadly uses as well. Glaceon has just finished harvesting a fresh crop of power stones to be used in the construction of Halcyon's newest marvel, a floating temple, when a young man appears in the control chamber. This man has no business being here, has no business being anywhere in Halcyon. He is one of the damned, an untouchable caste within Thran society, which live in underground caves below the city. Somehow, this young man has managed to escape those caves and navigate the hidden passages which connect the caves of the damned to the cavern of the Mana Rig. The young man attacks Glaceon, stabbing him with one of his own power stones, then flees. Glaceon is taken to an infirmary to be healed, but the power stone still remains within his body. The effects of the power stone negate the magic employed by the healers, and to remove the stone surgically would violate a Thran taboo. They are just basically watching him die as they wring their hands and do nothing to help him. Fortunately for Glaceon, his wife Rebecca joins him at his bedside. She is every bit the genius Glaceon is, but her specialty is architecture, not machines. She is, in fact, designing the Thran Temple, for which the new power stones would have been used. Rebecca does not hesitate once she realizes what is happening. She removes the power stone from her husband's body herself. Now he can be properly healed. A year or so after the attempted assassination of Glaceon, an itinerant healer and biologist named Yawgmoth returns to Halcyon after years in exile. His exile was the result of a century of political strife between two different political factions within the Thran Empire. Those supporting the artificers, who believed the best way to create a perfect society was through the use of machinery and magic, opposed by the eugenicists, who believed the best way to create a perfect society was by manipulating the physiology of the Thran themselves.
With the Artificer's Ascendant, the Eugenicists were banished from the Empire, Yawgmoth among them. But now Yawgmoth has been called back to Halcyon with great reluctance by the Elder Council of the city. Glacian, the genius of Halcyon, never recovered from the attack of the Mana Rig, and the Elder Council has become desperate. The healing magic which should have restored him after Rebecca removed the Power Stone has been ineffective. With no options available, the Elder Council has turned to Yawgmoth, hoping his controversial techniques might help the dying inventor. Yawgmoth returned to the city eagerly, seeing this as a chance to punish those responsible for his banishment. Yawgmoth is greeted at the entrance to the city by Rebecca herself. She was the one responsible for lifting Yawgmoth's exile and summoning him back to the city. Despite his overtly evil name, Yawgmoth can be quite charming, and Rebecca is immediately taken with him. Together, the two ascend the beautiful city of Halcyon in flying stand chairs propelled by power stones. I know this book was written in 1999, but I couldn't help but imagining the floating chairs from WALL-E when reading this part of the story. In the infirmary, Glacian is wasting away, and his skin is covered with oozing scabrous lesions. The lesions began to appear after the attempt on his life, but not even the highest-ranking healers in the city know why a simple stab wound would cause such symptoms. But sequestered in luxury, most of the sheltered inhabitants of Halcyon are unaware that Glacian's condition is not unique. All around the Empire, this illness is appearing with greater frequency. In fact, it is even running rampant in the caves of the damned beneath the city itself. This affliction is called phthiasis. Despite his deteriorating condition, Glacian is not happy to see Yawgmoth. He was one of the members of the Elder Council who voted to cast him out in the first place. Glacian sees Yawgmoth's methods as abominations and views Yawgmoth himself with intense dislike and distrust. Glacian would rather let the disease kill him than submit to Yawgmoth's treatment, but he does so at his wife's insistence. Yawgmoth's first priority is to obtain samples for analysis, which he does by using a scalpel to excise a piece of affected skin without the aid of anesthetic. This done, he begins his research into the mysterious affliction. In his pursuit of greater knowledge, Yawgmoth descends into the caves of the damned. It's a nightmarish, lawless, subterranean world of darkness and violence, existing just below the flawless beauty of Halcyon. Yawgmoth is set upon by a group of thugs who see this clean, healthy interloper as a potential victim. As it turns out, Yawgmoth's knowledge of anatomy isn't just useful for healing, but for killing as well. Using poison darts, he easily dispatches the leader and the rest back down. Yawgmoth demands to be taken to the person who attacked Glacian. A boy leads Yawgmoth to the quarantine caves, where those with phthisis are isolated from those who remain healthy. Here, he meets Glacian's assailant, a young man named Gix. If you know who Gix is, imagine I said his name with a flourish of dramatic music. Gix is even worse off than Glacian. Yawgmoth decides to treat the two men together, would-be murderer and would-be victim. Gix hates Glacian for what he represents, the elites of Halcyon who keep the Untouchables trapped like rats in a cage, despite all their rage. Glacian hates Gix for, well, stabbing him. But they are united in their hatred of Yawgmoth, who performs batteries of excruciating and humiliating tests and procedures upon both men, day after day, with seemingly no result. The only breakthrough Yawgmoth manages to achieve is to demonstrate that the condition is worsened by the sufferer's proximity to power stones. Glacian is no fool, however. They don't call him the genius of Halcyon for nothing. He knows Yawgmoth is no humble healer, but a schemer. Yawgmoth is essentially performing for the Elder Council, who anxiously await every update about the condition of their first citizen and about their city's most infamous criminal. Many of the common people begin to revere Yawgmoth, and many on the Elder Council are beginning to revere him as well, while the others look on in horror, wondering how they could admire such an obvious fraud. Meanwhile, Rebecca is slowly but surely falling in love with him, and he begins to rise through the ranks of society thanks to her influence as the city's chief architect. The city begins to divide into two camps, those who love Yawgmoth with a fanatical devotion, and those who fear what such a madman might do with real power. In the course of his quote-unquote research, Yawgmoth determines that power stones don't only exacerbate phthisis, they are the root cause of it. He explains this to Rebecca, who takes him before the Elder Council to present his findings. The council is dubious. Halcyites have lived alongside Power Stones for generations, and, with the exception of Glacian, only the Untouchables below the city seem to catch the disease. Glacian didn't contract the illness from a Power Stone, he contracted it from Gix. Yawgmoth proclaims that they are mistaken, that indeed citizens of the city are beginning to show signs of infection as well. He asks the council to give him resources to establish a corps of healers in the city to study and treat phthisis. Skeptics in the council aren't having it. They've received a letter from Glacian himself begging them to re-banish Yawgmoth. A vote is called, and, by the narrowest margin, Yawgmoth is allowed to remain in the city and given the resources he requires. The tie-breaking vote is cast by Rebecca herself. Meanwhile, Gix attempts to escape. He nearly kills Glacian again, but Glacian reminds Gix that, if he dies, all the Untouchables will be blamed for Gix's actions, and they will all be locked away to die. Frustrated, Gix allows Glacian to live. He flees back under the city to rejoin his people and to plan a rebellion against the world above. Yawgmoth establishes his healing corps and begins training apprentices. One day, as he is experimenting on Glacian before a rapt audience of students, a young man named Zod, that's Zod with an X, not a Z, makes an offhand comment that sparks an idea in Yawgmoth's mind. He and his students work together to create a new potential treatment, tiny particles of various metals suspended in a serum to be injected directly into the veins. But Yawgmoth won't try potentially fatal treatment on Glacian. The inventor's death would disrupt his plans. Fortunately, there is a riot happening outside. Gix has led his people up to the surface, up to the streets of Halcyon, where they walk, where they run, where they stay all day in the sun. But Gix doesn't want to be part of their world. He wants to destroy it. Yawgmoth is able to snatch an afflicted rioter off the street and drag him to his lab. There, the unwitting guinea pig is injected with the serum. To everyone's astonished delight, the lesions heal almost instantly. And then Yawgmoth kills him. He's a dangerous criminal, after all. Yawgmoth is pleased, of course. He suspects that this is only a temporary treatment, not a permanent cure, but it's good enough for now. Yawgmoth has seen an opportunity in the chaos of the riot. He knows that Gix will be leading the charge, and he knows that Gix's ultimate target will be the Thran Temple, and both men know Rebecca will be there. Yawgmoth leads his healers onto the street. Yawgmoth fights like a dervish with multiple swords, cutting a swath through the rioters. Inspired by their leader, his disciples join in the slaughter, using whatever weapons they can find. The group proceeds to the temple, where Gix has confronted Rebecca. Yawgmoth offers Gix a deal. He will give Gix a dose of the treatment now, and will promise to deliver more to the denizens of the Caves of the Dam if Gix and his followers will stand down. Gix agrees, is administered the treatment, and the rioters retreat to the caves. In the subsequent days, Yawgmoth ascends to the status of a national hero, both for ending the riot and for developing the treatment. He is given a place on the Elder Council, the place formerly occupied by Glacian, which has to sting worse than alcohol poured onto an infected lesion, which Yawgmoth also does to him on a regular basis. Yawgmoth is also assigned to lead a committee to oversee the restructuring of the army and the city guard, which failed so pitifully to quell the riot. To the people below the city in the Caves of the Damned, however, Yawgmoth is more than a hero, he is a savior, the man who will end their affliction once and for all. More than that, Yawgmoth has promised to raise them out of darkness and bring them into the world above permanently as citizens of Halcyon. Gix sees Yawgmoth for who he really is, but his warnings are ignored by Yawgmoth's adoring fans. With Yawgmoth in power, things begin to change quickly in the city. Warnings are posted everywhere listing the symptoms of the early onset of the phthisis, with admonitions to people not to hesitate in reporting friends, neighbors, or family members who might be afflicted. I'll read the list of symptoms to you just to give you an idea. Fatigue, irritability, excitability, lassitude, forgetfulness, confusion, paranoia, itchiness, blotches, rash, pallor, sweating, numbness, lesions, stiff joints, dizziness, nausea, diarrhea, constipation, changes in eating or sleeping habits, headaches, neck aches, or back aches. Basically every symptom there is. Those whom Yawgmoth believes are a risk to others are sent to the quarantine caves for treatment.
Meanwhile, those below the city who remain healthy are brought up in small groups on a regular basis. Those who ascend owe their salvation to Yawgmoth personally and will be assigned to the Health Corps, the elite organization of warrior healers over which Yawgmoth has absolute authority. While Rebecca continues to work on her temple, while Glacian's mind continues to deteriorate, and while Gix begins to lead healthy groups of refugees out of the caves, Yawgmoth is so successful at reorganizing the defense of the city that he is dispatched to the other city-states of the Thran Empire to do the same, as well as to establish health corps in each of the cities to combat Phthiasis. Yawgmoth is now not only the most powerful man in Halcyon, but the most powerful man in the whole empire, although his power is not yet secure. During a particular episode of Lucidity, Glacian receives a strange visitor, a woman named Dyfed, who appears seemingly out of nowhere. When his mind is clear, Glacian has been developing a theory about the nature of power stones, hypothesizing that each power stone might contain its own miniature universe. Dyfed is living proof of the existence of multiple universes, multiple planes of existence. She is a planeswalker, a human born with a special spark which allows her to travel the multiverse. Yawgmoth happens to be eavesdropping and introduces himself to Dyfed, who is impressed by Yawgmoth's dedication to the pursuit of science. He finds her claims of planeswalking hard to believe, however. As a demonstration, she takes Yawgmoth to visit another world. The wheels in Yawgmoth's mind begin to turn. Soon after, Halcyon is engulfed in another rebellion. The Untouchables, those not confined to the quarantine caves, rise up again led by Gix. This time, Yawgmoth is prepared. Yawgmoth has equipped the warrior healers of the Health Corps with armor enhanced by power stones. Together, the Health Corps and the City Guard drive the rebels back below and commit mass slaughter, sparing only those in the quarantine caves. Yawgmoth himself spares Gix in exchange for an oath of absolute loyalty, which Gix swears to save his own life. Yawgmoth's plan is coalescing now. Dyfed will find a plane untainted by the effects of power stones and create a portal linking Halcyon to this new world. The portal will be located in the very quarantine caves where the sick are housed. The sick themselves will be moved to the new world in order to recover without the danger of power stone radiation. In time, the Halcyites themselves may colonize this new world and dwell forever in Yawgmoth's utopia. But Yawgmoth's past is about to catch up with him. Months after the uprising, a celebration is held for the dedication of Rebecca's new temple. It is also a day to celebrate peace and victory for the city. Into this atmosphere comes a delegation of representatives of the many different human and non-human nations of Dominaria. The delegation is led by a dwarven ambassador, Prince Delsum of Oran Deeps. He rises to address the Elder Council of Halcyon and stuns the gathered leaders by demanding that Yawgmoth be extradited to face justice. He wants Yawgmoth punished for the crimes he has committed against the dwarves, against the elves, against the Minotaur, against the cat people of Jumeirah, and against the lizard people of Shiv, among others. He is accused of traveling from country to country during his time in exile and deliberately spreading illness wherever he went, either to gain power or wealth or simply to study the effects of the contagion. He is responsible for untold death and suffering, and the delegation demands his life as payment. The Elder Council decides to vote whether to turn Yawgmoth over for extradition or not. And, as we all know, there is no more effective way to punish political crimes than to allow those with a vested interest in the guilty party's acquittal to act as a jury. Yawgmoth will not be extradited. As a result of this refusal to meet their demands, the allied nations declare war on Halcyon. As a result of the declaration of war, Yawgmoth declares a state of emergency, dissolves the Elder Council, and appoints himself as the supreme ruler of the Thran people. Across the empire, his loyal Health Corps warriors take control of their respective cities. The former rulers are imprisoned. Yawgmoth at last decides to send Glacian down to the quarantine caves, telling Rebecca it is for his own good. And who does he put in charge of Glacian's care? Glacian's old pal Gix. Rebecca, ever the dupe, goes along with all of this, but she will not allow her fellow city elders to remain hostages. She asks Dyfed to use her planeswalking magic to take the elders to a new plane. Dyfed agrees, transporting Yawgmoth's political enemies to a new homeworld called Mercadia. Again, imagine dramatic music if you know what Mercadia is. Yawgmoth and Dyfed take Rebecca on a tour of the plane which will serve as an earthly paradise for the Halcyites. The plane is a series of spheres, one nested within another, leading down from the pristine world above to a single command center in the heart of the planet. It is an artificial world,
originally created by a dragon planeswalker, now long dead. Living machines keep the planet operational from the lower spheres. From the innermost sphere, one can control the plane itself. Yawgmoth renames his new homeworld Phyrexia, and he will be a god here. But there is still the matter of linking Phyrexia with Dominaria permanently. Dyfed creates a special power stone, which can be separated into two equal parts. As long as the two parts remain separate, the portal will remain open. The sick of the quarantine caves are shepherded into Phyrexia. There, Yawgmoth and his agents get to work, quote-unquote, perfecting them. In truth, they are turning them into monstrous living weapons of flesh and metal, implanting each with a power stone. From the center of his world, Yawgmoth can control every being on Phyrexia through these power stones, like a puppet master pulling countless strings. Back in Halcyon, an all-out war of attrition is being fought between the armies of the Thran Alliance against the armies of Halcyon, now simply referred to as the Phyrexians. The Phyrexian armies are commanded by Gix, transformed into an enormous black demon-like creature by Yawgmoth's bioengineers. Yawgmoth has a vast array of weapons at his disposal, airships armed with ray cannons, implosion bombs which suck the energy out of anything caught in their blast radius, even a weapon which creates a fog of pure mana energy which settles below Halcyon and destroys anything caught out in the open. Yawgmoth's greatest weapon, however, is the Null Sphere, kind of like a mini Death Star, which was originally designed to control the Halcyite machines. However, Yawgmoth has repurposed it, allowing it to send pirate signals to hack the machine soldiers of the Thran Alliance, causing them to turn on their own forces. At last, Rebecca has seen what a monster Yawgmoth truly is and plans to escape the city, flying away in the floating Thran Temple, hopefully carrying as many people as she can to safety. There are a few refugees remaining in the city, although most of the Halcyites have gone to Phyrexia to volunteer to be transformed. Of course, they don't quite comprehend what they're going to be transformed into. Dyfed likewise realizes her folly in aiding Yawgmoth, but before she can do anything about it, Yawgmoth stabs her in the brain, incapacitating her but not killing her. He wants to study Dyfed to find out the source of her innate planeswalking ability, hoping to gain the ability for himself. And by study, I mean dissect. Yawgmoth learns of Rebecca's plan to escape and foils it, bringing her to Phyrexia with him, where she will be under his complete control. Leaving her there, thinking her secure, he returns to Halcyon to continue the war, but Rebecca manages to shake off Yawgmoth's control. She finds Dyfed, still alive, and puts her out of her misery. She finds Glaceon and smuggles him out of Phyrexia through the portal connecting the two worlds. Her plan is to take Glaceon to the temple, where 2,000 refugees have already gathered, hoping they can fly to safety. But Gix and his warriors reach the temple first, blocking the escape. Yawgmoth and his troopers arrive by airship and attack as well. In the ensuing battle, the temple itself falls from the sky, killing all the refugees who remained within. But worse is yet to come. The artificers who control the Null Sphere betray Yawgmoth. The power of the Null Sphere is all that keeps the deadly mana clouds which Yawgmoth has released upon the invading forces from engulfing Halcyon itself. The artificers pilot the sphere higher and higher into the atmosphere, too high for its power to protect the city any longer. Their final hope, before they die of hypoxia, is that the cloud will destroy Yawgmoth and his followers forever. All those who remain in the city, refugees and enemy combatants alike, begin to flee into the caves of the damned, hoping to escape the killing fog. Yawgmoth happily invites all of them to his new paradise, and he is there to greet them. The refugees enter Phyrexia only to realize, too late, that this world is indeed a paradise, but the kind of paradise that could only be dreamt up by a twisted and evil mind like Yawgmoth's. His plans have been disrupted by the betrayal of the artificers, but not halted. The fog will clear in time, then he and his perfected Phyrexians can conquer all of Dominaria. Only Rebecca remains behind in Halcyon. Glaceon has finally died after years of suffering. As Rebecca is mourning her husband, she notices something strange. It appears as if a power stone has been implanted under Glaceon's skin, then stitched in place. Rebecca removes the stitches and finds not one, but two power stones. These two power stones, two halves of a whole, are the same ones that Dyfed used to create the portal between Dominaria and Phyrexia. Yawgmoth, out of pure cruelty, implanted both in Glaceon to increase his suffering as he died, as a kind of final insult and a final torment. Rebecca brings the two stones together, and they fuse into one. At that moment, the voice of Glaceon speaks to her. his consciousness has been transferred into the United Stone. He instructs Rebecca to place the stone on the pedestal which Dive had created to control the operation of the portal. As Rebecca approaches the pedestal, she can see Phyrexia through the opening. From the other side, Yawgmoth calls out to Rebecca, trying to coax her to join him rather than remain in Halcyon and die. Yawgmoth will not step through the portal back into Halcyon, even to stop her, knowing he might become trapped. Glacian urges her to separate the two worlds forever. At last, Rebecca places the Power Stone upon the pedestal, and the portal slams shut. Yawgmoth is trapped. Phyrexia and Dominaria are sealed off from one another forever. With everyone and everything she ever loved gone, Rebecca steps into the Mana Cloud, joining her husband and her city in death. All right, so that was The Thran by J. Robert King. Yawgmoth has been driven from Dominaria, but he's been sealed away in Phyrexia to live forever and rule as a god over a planet of thralls. Talk about failing upward. Unfortunately for Dominaria, this is a prequel, and every prequel needs a sequel. It will take centuries, but eventually the ruins of Halcyon will be rediscovered by two enterprising young archaeologists named Urza and Mishra. Deep inside, they will find a power stone, one which will split into two, the Might Stone and the Weak Stone, and inadvertently open a link between the worlds again. And who will be there to step through but our old friend Gix, a sewer urchin turned cyber demon, ready to kick ass for Yawgmoth. The Thran is a strange novel, atypical for many fantasy novels since the protagonist is also the villain, and we're made aware of this fairly early on. I mean, his name is Yawgmoth. It's the most villainous name in all of fantasy, second only to Wormtongue, and he's a eugenicist. If you're unfamiliar with eugenics in a real-world context, you're lucky. Basically, eugenics was an idea popularized in the early 20th century, the bastard child of Darwinism, which advocated, quote-unquote, improving the human species by weeding out, and imagine I'm doing giant emphatic air quotes here, undesirables. I won't go into detail, but it was an unethical and unscientific practice in any circumstances, but was taken to its most horrific extremes under the Nazis. So, if you ever meet someone claiming to be a eugenicist, stay as far away from that person as possible. I think the novel's strange attempt to build a narrative around a villain is mostly successful, however. It is uncomfortably fascinating watching Yawgmoth's rise to power, using charisma, propaganda, deception, and of course murder, to rise from a disgraced healer to the ruler of a continent-spanning empire. I think it works because he's a compelling character. He's ruthless, sadistic, narcissistic, probably downright sociopathic, but he's intelligent and courageous as well. King is careful to make sure that the characters opposing Yawgmoth, like Glacian and Gix, are downright unlikable. Yawgmoth is the only character we can admire, except possibly for Rebecca and Dyfed, but they're both so easily duped you can't really help but roll your eyes at it. It's also interesting, and I imagine this was on purpose, how Yawgmoth's rise to power echoes Urza's rise to power as well. Both are men of vast genius and vast ambition. They rise from relatively humble circumstances to control great nations and armies using patience and intellect, not brute force. Both men see far beyond what ordinary people can see and transform their visions into reality. In a way, it's fitting that the two would become immortal enemies. They are not so different, Yawgmoth and Urza. I enjoyed the portrayal of Gix as well. We don't actually meet Yawgmoth in the Brothers' War, so Gix is the only character who appears in both novels. In The Brothers' War, he is a bestial monster who sucks out people's brains and turns Mishra into an inhuman killing machine, literally. In The Thran, he's just an angry punk who's so full of rage at the world that he leads not one but two bloody rebellions against the Halcyite elite. But Gix is a coward at heart. Twice, he comes close to freeing his people and twice he backs down to save his own life. When he is ultimately given the choice to die or to live as Yawgmoth's slave, he chooses to follow Yawgmoth to Phyrexia. My least favorite character is definitely Rebecca. I mean, just her name is annoying. Am I supposed to put the stress on the second syllable, like Rebecca, or am I supposed to put it on the first syllable, like rabbit? She starts out as a promising character. She's a brilliant architect and artist who creates marvelous buildings whose designs are rich with symbolism. She's married to one of the most influential men in the city, but she's every bit his equal. But then she spends about 80% of the novel under Yawgmoth's spell up until the very end. And I'm using the word spell metaphorically, since Yawgmoth is not a wizard of any kind. It's kind of silly, but when I was reading the scenes between Rebecca and Yawgmoth, I kept imagining Anna with Prince Hans at the Southern Isles from the first Frozen. Rebecca's blinded by love, and she just can't let it go. Dyfed isn't much better. She shows up in Halcyon as this seemingly omnipotent planeswalker, but with all her power and her experience, she is incapable of seeing through Yawgmoth's facade until it's too late. There's nothing like a spike to the brain to open your eyes. While I'm on the subject, I want to discuss one of the novel's biggest flaws. The story really moves forward on two different tracks. The first track is the story of Yawgmoth and his rise to political and military power in Halcyon. The second track is Yawgmoth's plan to create his version of a utopia on Phyrexia with himself as its god. The first track runs smoothly. The second, not so much. First, there's the obvious problem of Yawgmoth's motivation. Does he want to conquer Dominaria, or does he want to rule his own planet? The answer seems to be both, but why? If Yawgmoth has absolute power and immortality on Phyrexia, why does he even care about Dominaria anymore? All of his enemies are dead. It's not like he's seeking vengeance. It seems like a contrivance to explain why Yawgmoth would even bother coming back to Dominaria in the later Magic the Gathering story. And the mechanics of it are confusing as well. I get that there is a lot of magic involved, but magic should at least follow its own rules. Dyfed finds a plane that was created by a different planeswalker who has since died and gives that plane to Yawgmoth. Why not just find him a brand new plane? I think this was done for the sake of expediency, so Yawgmoth could simply step in as the new pilot of a ship already in motion, rather than having to spend years shaping Phyrexia into his own personal fiefdom. And don't get me started on how separating a single power stone creates a portal and fusing the halves closes it. That part made no sense. The author just needed a way to get the Might Stone and the Weak Stone into place for Urza and Mishra to eventually find. I have to say that 2021 was an odd year to be reading this book. I kept finding parallels between the events of the novel and events of the last few years. There's a deadly illness whose danger many people refuse to make any lifestyle changes to mitigate. There's uprisings among the disenfranchised citizenry who have been relegated to second-class citizen status without any rights or resources, followed by violent crackdowns. There's conflict between superstitious science deniers and materialistic magic deniers. And of course, there's an aspiring authoritarian ruler using fear and lies to rise to power regardless of the suffering he leaves in his wake. Ultimately, I would recommend Thran to fans of Magic the Gathering lore who are interested in seeing Yawgmoth the man before he became Yawgmoth the god, but I wouldn't recommend it to the general fantasy fan who is probably going to miss a lot of the Easter eggs and will certainly be bored by the final act of the novel, which is mainly preoccupied with battles between the Thrans and the Phyrexians. If you're like me and you aren't a fan of prolonged battle sequences in novels, you may find yourself just skimming over those chapters. But if you grew up playing Magic the Gathering during its golden age, there's probably more than enough for you to enjoy. That's all for today. Thanks for listening, and until next time, remember, never turn your back on a power-mad sociopath. You might end up having scrambled brains for breakfast.